You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's show, we enter a world of the bizarre, of the weird, of the strange, the world of oddities in print. With his third book, Adam Benedict takes us to a time long forgotten to uncover some of the strangest stories ever committed to print. Adam and I discuss some of our favourite reports he has uncovered in his marvellous new book, Oddities in Print. From a bear that catches a ferry, a mysterious group of people appearing from nowhere, the moral dilemma of Bigfoot's modesty, stories of strange lights in the sky, strange and unusual tables, weird creatures, and the fabulously incredible story of the human cucumber. Adam's book is a fantastic compendium of wonderfully weird and eccentric newspaper reports garnered from around the USA in the 19th and early 20th centuries. As always, before we start the show, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up to Patreon at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. There you'll get early releases, ad-free episodes, bonus content, and more. A big welcome to my latest Patreon, Victoria. Thank you, Victoria, and welcome to the team. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also find the mysteriesandmonsters.com website, where you can get your merchandise from the tabs at the top of the page. As always, thank you to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, let's join Adam Benedict to re-evaluate what you may consider the oddest stories you've heard before this episode. On today's show, we dive into a world of weirdness that is often overlooked in the modern era. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, newspapers would be the only source of information for the general public, and as such, would print some of the strangest, weirdest, and oddest accounts possible. Thankfully, for us lovers of the weird, Adam Benedict has collected a mammoth tome of these in his fabulous new book, Oddities in Print. Adam, your third appearance. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Thanks for having me back. Always good when we can catch up and chat like once a year.
Yes, it is. It does seem quite an irregular regularity, which is always
nice. It does. Yeah, and it goes really fast too, though, between the talks. It's like, oh man, we talked a year ago already.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of those strange things about the world these days. It seems that time is both speedier and slower, depending on how we view it. And we're in a very malleable period of time, I think, Adam.
Completely agree.
Now, this book, for anybody who has not collected your two previous works, which were both fantastic collections, but primarily focused on one particular subject, which is Ghosts in Print and Monsters in Print. Oddities in Print is absolutely fabulous. From top to bottom, Adam, I congratulate you on it, because it is such a compendium of craziness that how anybody who picks this book up doesn't find dozens of stories to keep them entertained, I do not know, because there are stories covering wild men, strange ghosts, disappearing people, strange creatures. We've got flying monsters, we've got ships that don't respond unless they get a paint coat.
Yeah.
Weird people that lurk about, babies that just get given to people as presents. There's something for everybody in this who has a slant to the weird, Adam.
A few Philosopher's Stone stories as well, as also perpetual motion machines, which are always fun.
Absolutely. I would imagine that the hardest thing about a book like this, Adam, is deciding what
not to include, because as we were joking before we started our proper conversation, when your book turned up, I was like, whoa, how big is this? But that just makes it even better, because when you start reading through these stories, you're just like, these are fabulous. These are fabulous. These are fantastic. They're so strange. They're so weird. And as I touched on, you haven't kind of, I think this has given you carte blanche to basically say, right, this is what I like. Welcome to my world.
Yeah, definitely with this book, you know, I took my love of, you know, classic unsolved mysteries and In Search Of, which I, you know, I sing their praises every time I talk to someone, because that's what opened the door for me to get into this. And, you know, their setup was multiple different stories all at the same time, like per episode or per season for, in terms of In Search Of, you know, you're going to have one topic per episode, but those topics for a season run the gambit of what they can be. So that was kind of the mindset going into this one, is you're going to get a bunch of different things, but all fall under the category of odd. With Ghosts in Print and Monsters, it was very focused on what it was about. And that's what, you know, in the beginning with the website and stuff, that's kind of what we were focused on. It's like, oh, we're gonna be a cryptid website, and you know, we're gonna write about monsters, and then it kind of expanded. We're doing some weirder stuff. We're gonna talk about ghosts. And when people responded positively to that, and then they, you know, they started understanding like what the website and what the PBI, the Pine Barrens Institute, was about. It's kind of like, okay, now you know we exist. Now you know that this is out there. Now I'm going to open the door, and it's just going to be an onslaught of different things you can, at any given time, we might cover. And this was that chance to just kind of run free and talk about anything and everything.
Absolutely. You kick the door open, and you're running amongst the pastures of the weird, Adam.
Yeah.
I often find it unusual, a bit like yourself, Adam, that I have so many varying interests in the Fortean field. Yes, I love monsters and ghosts and sea serpents, but I also love really odd stories. I love stories about rains of fish and frogs and things like that, and spontaneous human combustion and strange discoveries and crazy wild men running around attacking people's horses and things. So when I got your book, I was like, well, I know that there are hundreds of weird stories, both in America and in the British press, that have been printed over the years. And some are just far-flung flights of fancy from a few choice journalists, shall we say. But there are many a nugget of real Fortean themes that you can see developing 200 years ago that are still with us today, where you have even a brief flick through the first couple of chapters, because once again you've put them into the decades, so we're going chronologically through the time periods. And it's very interesting for me to see, even back then, that stories of sea serpents, hairy wild men, which are probably better known these days as Bigfoot or Sasquatch, giant birds, giant snakes, poltergeists, all these started appearing 200 years ago. And it's very interesting, I think, that often people of a skeptical slant will say, oh, well, these are all fairly modern things, and they only started when Ray Wallace found his tracks, or people found the Yeti, or when Nessie was photoed in the 1930s. And yet, once again, as always, the historical record shows that that's simply not true. These stories have been with us centuries.
Right.
So when you look at that, I find it remarkable that some of these early accounts are very similar to what gets reported today. Some of them are a little outlandish, and some are far-fetched. And as I had a recent conversation with Chad Lewis about some of his lumberjack tales, which are obviously far-flung fables to keep people on their toes in the dead of winter, there are some stories that come in here. But even the very first story, Adam, that you give us in this collection is one of those stories that I find it lovely when I find a strange story, and I, as I'm reading it, there's just a big smile on my face, because it's so silly, and yet It's delightfully charming. It makes you chuckle. And you think, well, we know animals can do strange things. And so...
yeah.
And there's a few of these throughout the decades of animals that seem to be a little bit more intelligent than we give them credence for. And this first story that you give us on page 2 of your book is entitled Bear Ferry from the Hillsborough Recorder in 1822, which was from North Carolina, which essentially tells us the story of a farmer who lived on a lake shore who saw a bear that was trying to cross the bay, and he decides to get on his boat and just go out into the bay and keep away from the bear. And yet, all of a sudden, the bear seems to think, I could perhaps utilize this chap's transport.
Yep, he's gonna take advantage of the impromptu ferry that's coming his way because he doesn't want to swim anymore.
So here we have a big bear that thinks, I'm going to hitch a ride on this chap's skiff. So this chap thinks, ooh, I'm not keen on this. And I think this is remarkable because is it 3 times he tries to turn the boat back to head back, and every time he does, the bear just gives him a...
Yeah, he attempted it 3 tries, and it always ended in the same result. The bear would not let him do it. He wanted to go to a specific place, and he was going to make sure that farmer took him to that place. And the farmer was just like, I guess I have no choice. I have to do it.
So our friend the farmer thinks, you know, this bear's clearly very grumpy. Takes him to near the shore of the island where this bear obviously was wanting to get to. The bear departs, and they both leave happy that neither has come to blows.
The thing I love about this story is when I first came across it, it's kind of like, you know, we've all had those situations where you're like with your dad or your uncle or someone, you know, that they're kind of like quiet and they haven't told you everything about their childhood, and they'll just randomly tell you a story where you're just like, why haven't you ever said that before? And that's how this one comes across. It's like, yeah, did I tell you the time that I had to row a bear across a lake? And it's like, what? And it's like, no, I had to do that. Like, that's how this comes across, where it's so unbelievable, but it's like, yeah, I guess you could have done that. Like, sure.
Absolutely. Stranger things have happened. We had a walrus turn up in the UK last year that seemed to be on holiday, Adam, because it kept turning up in different places. So a lot of people were sort of putting forth the possibility that the walrus had just come to the UK for a break.
Now, like, flash forward, like, you know, decades from now, you know, there's that one person who's telling, like, their kid, it's like, yeah, I was going to work one day and I saw a walrus. And they're like, no, you didn't. It's like, no, I did. And it's kind of like, okay, I guess you did.
Well, there seems to be, there's often something remarkable about an animal that turns up somewhere where it's just not supposed to be. Obviously, in certain parts of the States at the minute, a lot of people are getting very excited that there's a Stellar Sea Eagle flying around, which is one of those majestic creatures that, until you see it close up, you're amazed just how large they are. And yet, it's not unknown, Adam, for walruses to turn up here in the UK. But they are quite rare. And the right. Funny thing about this was people saying, oh, yeah, it's like once in a generation. And then 6 months later, a different one turned up. So
it heard it's the place to be.
Absolutely. Clearly, you know, post-lockdown, come to Britain. You great fish, lovely views, friendly locals. Why not?
I mean, will you sell it like that? I'll go. I'll take the advice of you and the walrus, and that's my next travel destination.
Excellent, excellent. I think maybe there's a career choice for walruses in future, that tourism is a career that they can look forward to. As I touched on there, Adam, there are numerous stories of animals showing wonderful talents throughout, but I think we'll save a couple of those for later on. What's one of your other favourite stories that you came kind of uncovered? Because I think we've both got a great selection of some of the fabulous accounts that you've uncovered for us here. So what's one of your favourites?
So just a little background. It usually takes for like writing these or compiling them, I should say. It takes about a year, and it's just going to different, you know, digital library archives, going through their stuff. And it's just getting a big selection where I just kind of gather up and like a Word document, all their links, and I'll save them, and then I'll go back and I'll read them. And it's like, if it doesn't strike something where it's like, okay, that falls into what I'm looking for, or, you know, as you read it, you're like, no, I really think that was a hoax or something like that. You know, I get rid of it. I kind of do this reading process in the beginning, and then also while I'm putting it together. And there was a story that I read early on, and it, for some reason, it really stuck with me, because it was like one of those stories that I read as a kid that really makes an impression on you because of the image that it gives you while you're reading it. And so I of course had to put it in. But it's on page 88, and it's called A Remarkable Phenomenon. And the title that it was given, you'll notice early on in the early 1800s, a lot of the stories, they didn't have like a really crazy headline. They just gave them like generic titles, like singular phenomenon or remarkable phenomenon or singular event. It was just like a coverall headline. It's like, here's a weird story, run it, you know, Yes. There you go. But this one, they called A Remarkable Phenomenon, and it took place October 7th, 1863, in the Weekly Standard in North Carolina. It took place at the house of Mrs. Percy, but it was witnessed by a Mr. Moses Dwyer, her neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And he was at her home, like on the porch. So they were sitting outside, and they witnessed like these strange clouds begin to roll in. The day was really hot. There was no clouds in the sky at the time, but then all of a sudden, like the wind started to blow and these clouds rolled in, and the clouds were tinged with like light green, almost kind of like a light green light. And they were watching them. And then all of a sudden they noticed, like following these clouds, these strange covered clouds, like a whole bunch of people wearing like loose, like the same type of outfit, kind of marching, following these clouds. And they said there was like thousands of them that came through the valley, traveling in the same direction, marching, following these strange looking clouds. And then they just kept on their way, and then they were gone. And then they mentioned in the article that almost an identical event was seen about 4 miles east of the woman's house. It's just like, what was happening? You know, who were these people that were following these weird clouds? What were the clouds? What was the source of the light? It's just all these questions. And it just gives you this mental image of like a cult.
Yes.
Like following along, like some crazy cult who just disappear. And I don't know why, but this story is like stuck with me. And I occasionally think about it. Like, what would you do if you were sitting on your porch and you saw, you know, this strange aerial phenomenon, these strange people, and then they were just gone?
I think one of the things they do mention as well is that they all seem to be dressed the same as well, Adam, which gives this kind of eerie sort of response to it, that you're thinking, well, not only where did they come from, but where are they going? What's happening here?
Yeah, they said they moved kind of like they had strict military discipline. So they were all marching in the same type of movement. So it was, yeah. What was it about? What were they doing? Where did they go? It was just, it leaves kind of like an eerie feeling, at least for me reading it, like very, like unsettling type.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, we're just seeing a large group of people appear. And some people say, well, that's not particularly strange. But when you add in the uniformity of everybody, these green tinge clouds that came rolling in on a hot summer's day, it makes it an eerie occurrence that is very unusual, because obviously as well, in those days, a large group of people would be quite noticeable, even because most cities in those days were not massive sprawling metropolises that they are today, Adam. So a large group of people would be a substantial sight for anybody in any part of the US at that time.
Well, especially too, because, you know, at that time when they were establishing these towns and these cities and stuff like that, there was always, you know, typically one main road and maybe a few off roads. And that was the main source of, you know, directional transportation these people would take. But these people were not walking along the road. It's, they were coming down the mountains, like through the valleys and stuff, and just out in nature. So almost as if they were hidden, or there was some place that on the outskirts of the town that people didn't know about. It was just, and for that amount of people, it's, yeah, it just leaves more questions than answers. And I, that's why I love it.
It's one of those stories as well that it's not the, the retelling of a standard tale, because often we get very similar stories that get reported a decade apart in different parts of the states, where clearly somebody had been somewhere, heard this story, gone back to their particular state, and ended up kind of giving a remixed version of the original tale. And you can see that especially in a lot of paranormal stories, Adam, and early Wild Men stories that seem to pop up, that some of them do seem rather similar apart from names get changed and things like that. And so one of the surprising things to discover so early in your book is one from West Virginia, which is entitled A Giant Story. Now, this made me sit up, because in this day and age, this particular story is often put forward as one of the first reports of alleged cryptids running around in one of the most notoriously strange areas of the US, which is the Okefenokee Swamp area. And I was very surprised to see that this story was first printed in 1829, so nearly 200 years ago. And even in this day and age, Adam, I will see this story mentioned online probably every 3 to 6 months by varying sites and YouTube channels and things, which I think shows some of it shows the actual quality of some of these stories, that they're still with us 2 centuries later in whatever form. And this, as far as I'm aware, is clearly the first time this story had ever been printed.
Right. And let me touch on that just real quick. You know, you get these stories that, you know, you said you come across like on various websites or YouTube or people talking about them. Mm. But I don't know about you, but a lot of the times when that happens, like, you never get like the full original story. It's the people talking about it or making reference to it.
Yeah.
So it's like when you can stumble upon like, this is the actual article they are talking about, and you're getting the whole picture. It's always refreshing to see. It's like, how come they never talk about that part in the video? Or this is the first time I've heard this. So it's like, yeah, you might come across some stories in here that you've heard of, but you've never actually read them as they appeared in the paper. So that was always a fun part too, when you could come across those stories that people still talk about today, and you can see them in their originality, how they were actually written back in the day. And you can use that moving forward, and you come across like videos or articles where they reference that. It's like, oh, that's what they're talking about.
I think it's very interesting. It was very sad. When I was speaking to David Weatherly recently, we were talking about his book on Montana, the Big Sky Monsters book. And obviously one of the most famous Bigfoot stories is the Bauman case, which is obviously very famous because obviously it was written by Roosevelt. And I ended up catching a program this week, and they talked about that. And the version they mentioned on this program wasn't the actual original story. It was clearly, as you say, it was a version of a version. And I was very surprised, because the person who was telling the story is a very, very, very well-known member of the cryptid community, who has had a major television show that ran for several years. So I was very surprised that his version of the story isn't the actual story. And David was saying he had exactly the same opinion as yourself there, that you will find these older stories where the version we see now isn't actually the original version. It's been changed. It's like rumors. Every telling, it changes slightly in some regard, Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And this was that the Bauman case was one of those. So David just printed the original chapter from the book and said, right, this is exactly how it was written at the time, which I think the book came out end of the 19th century when it was released. And so that's the original account, which is one of those where it's quite a creepy story when you read it.
Yeah.
Compared to it's one of those stories that I don't understand why people have exaggerated it in the modern era, because the original telling of the story by Bauman, there is this creeping sort of feeling that something really bad's going to happen, but you don't know what, you just know something bad's coming. So I don't understand why exaggeration and things get added to these kind of stories, because they're very creepy in their own light, in their own right, sorry. So this is another one. And like I say, I was surprised. I'd heard this story was very old. I didn't realise it was this old. This story regards a group of gentlemen who have heard stories or legends that there are a race of giants that live in the swamp and seem excited and interested and think, right, oh, well, we can make his fortune. If we bag ourselves a giant, we're made for life. We'll be world famous. We'll be millionaires, whatever. So they decided to follow up on some witnesses who'd claimed to have stumbled across some large footprints. And then they decide to take a trip into the swamp and set up camp when they are attacked, allegedly, by this giant who essentially just comes charging into their camp full of anger, and clearly they've met their match. So this giant is apparently running amok. They're shooting at it with their rifles, and eventually they take this giant down and they kill it, but it's killed five of the party, and the rest of them tidy everything up, clean down everything that's happened. They're in shock. They can't cope with what's happened, and eventually they just get out of this area and get back to civilization to try and tell people of this horrific event that's happened to them, and claim that this giant's 13 feet long and how many gunshots it took to take him. They therefore had to sort of... One of the aspects of this story for me is one of those where a group of people go into a swamp and only half of them come back, and they tell this incredible story of this giant ripping the heads off them as well, which is always a strange aspect of this story, Adam, that I've often found, why was it pulling their heads off? Which is something I've seen in a couple of other alleged legends. I mean, one's often put forward as a true encounter between Native Americans and a tribe of child-snatching Bigfoot. But when you actually go into the electoral register, you'll realise that the person who supposedly heroically dies didn't die, and he lived for quite a long time, which kind of makes you think, well, I don't think this story's true then. And yet this story is essentially 1829. The meat and bones of it are exactly the same. It hasn't really changed that much.
What's interesting, I think, though, about this story too, which adds like a double layer to it, is it starts out talking about a legend already. It starts out, they're talking about that there's a place in the Okefenokee which has, you know, a race of mortals, but they're gigantic. You know, that this party originally becomes lost, and they're approached by these like giant women who essentially help them out, and they, you know, they give them water and food, and they help them out of the swamp. But they warn them that like their husbands, who are much bigger than them, you know, are very, very territorial and fierce towards normal people. So to get out of the swamp, like, they really need to avoid them. So it's like, if that legend existed before this story is said to happen, you know, something had to have happened around that area to bring that legend into being. And then to hear, you know, that the second party encounters like what would obviously be the husband or one of the husbands of the giant women who helped them. It's like, okay, it's so there's something very weird going on here, because that's one thing, like, you don't hear, if this is like an early description of what could be described as, you know, modern Bigfoot or anything like that, you don't really hear any more stories of them being like fierce and angry like that. And you also don't really hear stories of like the women or like family units. You know, you have the Albert Ostman, you know, classic story where he's kidnapped by like a family.
Yes.
Of Bigfoot, but it's like you don't hear often of multiple wives and multiple of the husbands of what would be, I guess, you know, we call Bigfoot and stuff like that. So it's like there's a lot of interesting layers that for some reason we don't hear about anymore, or they've just been chosen to be left out in the retellings. Because, yeah, look at stories from the early 1800s, like these wild men or modern day Bigfoot they're described now as like, oh, they're gentle and they're passive and, you know, they're more akin to just watch you from the shadows. But back then it's like, no, they will charge you and they will kill you.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, let's leave those aspects out of it and let's kind of craft the narrative now into something completely different.
Clearly, it's had a major rebrand, I think.
I mean,
when you looked at I remember when we were speaking about some of these stories in the Monsters book, I was jokingly saying that there seemed to have been a lot of red-headed men that ran off to live in the woods, because when you look at these reports from a lot of that period of time, Adam, I often find it odd that they say it's clearly a man, he's just covered in hair, which obviously these days we know that if people go into live in the woods or wherever, the only thing that's really going to grow is a beard and the hair. The body's not going to get covered in hair.
Right.
That's a very interesting aspect of some of these older stories, that it's almost as if they perceive you to be able to turn feral if you leave civilization and go into the wilds. You become an animal. And often a lot of these stories, now maybe that's because they weren't aware of what apes were really, other than, you know, sort of chimpanzees and things that they may have seen on a travelling zoo or a circus passing through. And obviously, as many a cryptid investigator will know, escaped chimps from zoos are responsible for quite a lot of Bigfoot accounts, it would seem, despite the fact that there doesn't seem to be any evidence of these escapees or train crashes involving circuses, Adam.
Right. Here's an aspect I was actually, this gets off the path of the book, but I think it's just from something you said, you know, it's interesting. And I was actually thinking about it this morning as I was just going about, you know, my daily morning routine and stuff. This random thought just popped into my head. You read all these historical accounts and they always talk about the wild man, and they always make it a point to mention that, you know, it was wearing like a tattered loincloth or tattered clothes. Mm. But like you said, you know, it was covered in hair, and people aren't just going to all of a sudden grow hair when they're out there. So it's almost like, did they just add that in for the sake of modesty? Because people might not have been able to handle like a naked individual running around out there.
Mm.
So if they're covered in hair, which isn't going to happen, then they're not going to like make it a point to, oh, I need to wear like a loincloth so I don't offend people. It's almost like they put that in the article so people are like, you know, the classic scenes in old movies, like, you know, hand on the chest, like, oh my God, oh no, this is immoral and I can't read this. So it's like an interesting, just kind of little thing to notice, like when the loincloth stops being mentioned and it's turned into more of an animal rather than like a wild man.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, maybe that's also responsible for why some of these early reports, they say they're wearing loincloths or tattered clothing. Because once again, regardless, if you see a naked creature running about, there's a good chance you're going to be seeing things you're not particularly wanting to.
Right. And it's like, they don't want to write about that. They don't want to offend people. They're, you know, especially since a lot of these people at the time were coming over, immigrating from different countries where their views on a lot of stuff were not all the same. So it's like, let's just play it safe and, you know, hold that modesty in our storytelling, just so nobody is offended and we can print the story and then move on, type of thing. I don't know. It's an interesting thought. Is there any proof behind it? No. But as you go through the stories through the years, you can see that like being a main topic they really like to point out.
Yeah, I think it is one of those aspects. I've kind of touched on this with other people I've spoken with, Adam, in regards to a number of phenomenons where it seems that we often look back at things with our modern interpretation of what we can read in the news media or the information that we're used to being given. And we forget that for a lot of these people, these were church-going people, these were religious people of a variety of denominations. They may have had moral obligations not to kind of tell us everything that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think, once again, it's an aspect of it that I think, only looking back at the historical records, are we ever going to kind of look at what trends, and it'd be very interesting, like you mentioned there, at what point did they stop wearing clothes? That'd be an interesting point. When did society become open enough to stop dressing Bigfoot?
Right. I got a story here that another one that really like stuck out to me, and I believe it to be, if you were to classify it nowadays, it'd be considered an early UFO.
Mm.
Story, but not like the classic airship
yes
type of story. So that's one thing in the book too that you know, so many people were always asking for after the other ones, are you going to do a book on UFOs? Are you going to compile a book on UFOs? And it was a thought, but so many people have done, you know, historical UFOs.
Mm.
And that's one that, because there's so many good books out there with those stories in it, I didn't want to just walk on someone else's toes and just rehash things that, you know, more than likely people have already read.
Yes.
So there's smatterings of, I believe that's the word, of what could be described as like UFO stories in here, but they're not really the ones that are well known, and they're few and far between, but I did make sure to get some in here, and this is one of them. This one is called Curious Phenomenon. You know, that goes back to the let's give it a generic name because we don't want to dig too much into it. But this took place on – the story was written December 23rd, 1886 in the Times and Democrat from South Carolina. But it took place in Venezuela in October 24th of, I believe, 1885. And what it is it's talking about, you know, the night was rainy and there was a family of nine who were sleeping all together in one large hut. And they were awoken in the middle of the night by a loud humming noise and a vivid, dazzling light, which brilliantly illuminated the interior of the house. All the occupants woke up completely terror-stricken, and they assumed the world was coming to an end, and they threw themselves down and started to pray. But during their prayers, they all started violently vomiting. Extensive swellings started to appear on the upper portion of their bodies, which this light was hitting, especially on the face and lips. And it says, like, it must be noted that the brilliant light was not accompanied by a sensation of heat, although there was a smoky appearance and a peculiar smell. The next morning, after the light left, the family woke up and the swellings turned into large black blotches, but they couldn't feel any pain in those blotches until the ninth day when the skin started to peel off. And they kind of turned into violent raw sores, it said. It says their hair fell out where the light touched, and it happened to all nine family members. It also said what was extremely remarkable is that the house was completely uninjured. All the doors and windows were locked at the time, and no trace of lightning could be found, you know, to possibly explain maybe this was a lightning strike. And then they did notice, too, that all the trees around the house at the time showed no signs of injury, they describe as injury, until the ninth day as well, when they all started to develop the same type of sores that appeared on the family. They're saying this has to be more than pure coincidence, because they all experienced the same lapse of time, and whatever this was should not have been able to affect both plant and animal being people, you know, the exact same way. They said all the family members went to the hospital, but none of it was fatal. And that almost sounds like the classic the sci-fi depiction of a UFO taking off and, you know, radiation sickness, like from being trapped in this light it puts off as it takes off, you know, back into space.
Mm. Yeah, it's remarkable. As you say, I think often you've got to walk a fine edge with stories like this as well, Adam, I think. Because it's weird, without doubt.
Yeah.
It's a weird story. And as you say, I would imagine that some people will say categorically, right, it's definitely a UFO. It seems as though they have been exposed to something. This is the strange thing, as you say. And you think, well, that's weird enough. And as you mentioned there about the vegetation suddenly starts to develop it, but not at the same time, as though it's taken longer to start affecting that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very odd story. And obviously the person that's allegedly written this story works in the consulate, the US consulate in Venezuela at the time as well, if we are to believe what the author's occupation is. So here is a man of standing telling us of this unusual and strange occurrence that's left these people suffering from such strange effects.
Yeah, it's like reading it, you start to rack your brain. It's like, oh, maybe, you know, maybe like there was some underground gas or something that trapped, you know, close to the house that kind of leaked through that was causing the sores and stuff. But it's like that wouldn't explain the light. Maybe it was like a meteor that they saw which struck nearby, but it's like that wouldn't explain, you know, the nausea and the sores and stuff like that. So it's like your brain wants to link it to something it knows, but ultimately it's left with, I don't know. It's just odd. It just brings up in my mind reading it, you know, with the light and with the, you know, the falling on their knees to pray and stuff. It almost reminds me of that scene in Close Encounters when the young boy Barry is, the aliens are trying to abduct him out of the house, you know, and his mother is terrified and the lights are coming through the windows and the keyholes and through the chimney. And there's nothing that she can do. And then, you know, when they get what they want, they're just gone. Like, that's the vision that, like, pops into my head as I'm reading this, that same orange light and that weird humming sound, which turns on all the electronics and, you know, like that. Like, it definitely captures the sci-fi horror aspect perfectly when reading it through, like, a modern-day lens.
Absolutely. And also, I think you would be... It's a shame that it's so long ago, because I think if an event like that occurred now, I think people would be looking, because this is, you know, you could look at this, what happened to the family, as a secondary event, Adam, and what actually happened may have been some kind of abduction or some other kind of UFO sighting. And these people are the only witnesses remaining, perhaps. And that's why we've got this aspect to the story and not any real sighting other than the lights and the strange noise.
And it's interesting too that, like, the newspaper ran the story, but originally it was sent to, you know, the Scientific American. So they didn't go the route of, you know, let's just, like, a pulp newspaper at the time where it's like, oh, these stories, kind of like the Weekly World News. Like, they went to a reputable source of people that they were hoping could explain what happened. But I don't think anyone could.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting as well, because it kind of leads into the story that I found quite interesting that's quite similar. And as you mentioned earlier, this is the other... I love some of the titles of these stories, and it's very interesting that often they're just called things like, as you say, a strange phenomenon or a queer occurrence or unusual event. It's nothing too far out. It's just basically right. This is weird, is essentially what they're saying.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And this one is slightly early. It's from 1876, from the Ottumwa Weekly Courier. And once again, as I say, this is simply titled Phenomenon. Once again, this is September, and a group of people were out riding, going to a Highland township in the afternoon. And it was a beautifully sunny day when one of them pointed out their attention to something in the sky. They all look and saw to the northeast of them, and at around 300 yards high, a solid globe of fire. At first, when they saw it, it didn't seem to be moving, but as soon as they then started to watch it, it then started to move away from them. As it went away, it seemed to emit a blaze of fire. So you would say it looked a bit like a comet's tail, perhaps. And gradually it lost its globular form till it got within 50 yards of the ground. And then, as if by magic, it simply imploded and vanished into thin air. Now, that story really appealed to me because 10 years ago, Adam, I was sat at home at night just before I went to bed, and I caught... at the corner of my eye, something strange in the sky, and I watched it for about 45 minutes, and it was essentially a ball of fire floating across the sky of Sheffield. So I'm always interested when I hear stories like that, because you could say, I mean, this is the other thing. People say, oh, well, it was probably a meteor or a comet. But unless you've seen a meteor or a comet, when we hear these stories, these objects are moving quite slowly, because a meteor and a comet, you know, they are flying at thousands of miles an hour. You know,
right,
straight across the sky. They are not things that simply go slow enough for people to go, oh, look at that, that's a bit weird. Usually it's like, what? Like that. What was that? Whereas a lot of these stories, people are clearly able to watch these objects for a fair bit of time because they're able to describe it and say what they saw and everything. I don't know what I saw, but I know what it wasn't. And it was just very odd. I was convinced I'd seen some weird kind of meteorological phenomenon. I still to this day don't know what it was. Some people will tell me I've seen a UFO. I don't know what it was. I just know it wasn't a comet, it wasn't a meteor, it wasn't a Chinese lantern, it wasn't an airplane. It wasn't a reflection. So whenever I see stories like this that have been happening from that long ago, I think, well, is this something we're just not aware of? Because once again, we've got just a ball of fire floating along. But the other aspect of it is it explodes.
Right. And you think, like, you know, and a lot of there's a bunch of stories like that where they talk about things that exploded, but they make a point for people went to investigate. And then you read on and you're like, oh, this was like a meteor and stuff like this. But this one doesn't, you know, it doesn't read like that. Like it was gone before it hit the ground. And I don't really think it would have left anything behind because they would have noted that, like, it was just gone. So, like, it, you kind of get this, at least to me, like, the visualization that comes into my mind of, like, kind of like in Ghostbusters, like, the appearance that the ghosts take when they're floating around, like, that purple ball.
Yes.
Like, kind of like that, where it's just like, I know that's weird, but it, like, it makes sense in my mind, so I'm just going to watch it, and it's like, oh, now it's gone. Like, where did it go? Mm. Type of thing. And that, like, that's how they kind of, those weird lights, those weird floating lights and stuff. Like, that's how they always register in my mind. Like, it's got something to link it back to. So this is like, this is clearly like early, early advertisement for Ghostbusters, like a few hundred years later.
Yeah. I think the other interesting aspect of this particular story is what they don't say, because they don't say it makes a noise. It just vanishes. So once again, if it was a meteor or something of that description, it would have made an explosion. Even if it was an airburst one, it would go, you know, it would make a loud noise when it disintegrated. That happens quite a lot. Obviously, what happened a few years ago above the skies of Russia, that famous one that was managed to be caught on numerous dash cams and CCTV footage and caused widespread damage across a large area of a particular city. And so what they don't tell us, I find as interesting as the story, because clearly nobody reports it exploding. They just say it disappears, which is a very different thing.
Yeah, it like exploded into itself, back into where it came from, anything like that. But it didn't physically explode like a bomb or a meteor would. They're very strange. And I think that people, you know, nowadays are so kind of spoiled with like strange aerial phenomenon stories where it's like, oh, the lights did this, or, you know, it turned into a craft, or, you know, it's really exciting ones. But it's like to read a classic one where it's just something weird in the sky just doing its thing, like people don't appreciate them as much as they should anymore, because they definitely are in like their own classification of strange sky anomalies.
Yeah. And I think the other good thing about some of these older reports, Adam, is that they're very matter of fact. There's no whistles and bells and, oh, well, we think it was. They're not telling us what they think it is. They're just telling us what they've experienced.
Mm-hmm. Do you want a really weird one?
I'm always up for a really weird one.
This is one that I read, and I remember I read it, and I guarantee everyone has had one of those moments where, you know, you're at your computer or you're reading something on your phone, and you read it, and then you just kind of like sit back and you go, huh, what the hell was that? Like, and I remember reading this, and when I was done, I looked over at my wife and I was like, do you want to hear the weirdest thing you will hear all day? And this is what that story was. This is called A Human Cucumber. It was written in July 24th, 1889. It was in the Clifton Clarion from Arizona. And what this story is about, it's talking about this farmer who was cutting cucumbers from the vine, and he cut his hand while doing it. And he got some of the cucumber juice into his hand, and that caused some sort of reaction where, like, these sores started to appear all over his body. These sores then grew into like weird, they describe them as weird little pimples, but that morphed into being little cucumbers. So this man, they contacted the doctor, and the doctor then contacted like other scientific men, and they all came to look at him. You know, one of them wanted to bleed him. One wanted to cut the cucumbers off. Another one said, let's not give him any water so all the cucumbers dry up. you know, another said, let's stick a hole in each cucumber and they would die and the new skin would form. They all had different remedies, but then none of them could agree. And then the dude died. the small cucumbers grew into big ones, and his whole body was covered with them. All these cucumbers growing off of his skin. And then when they ripened, they turned yellow and they hung down, and it said the man assumed the appearance of a bunch of bananas. Then they all dried up, and so did the man. The doctors asked the family, hey, can we do an autopsy on this man for the benefit of science? They made sure to point out this is for the benefit of science and not for our own curiosity. They cut the man up with their knives, and to their amazement, inside they found no flesh, no bones, no muscles, nothing, just a bunch of cucumber seeds. The woman then took her cucumber husband's corpse and hung it up in the barn by its hair. The children the next spring went into the barn and picked up the seeds that fell out of this man's body. They then planted the seeds and then they grew them. But instead of cucumbers growing, pure pickles with no vinegar, pepper, salt, nothing, just started growing. So these people ate this man for years on end because these seeds kept being replanted. But this poor farmer turned into a cucumber. People essentially committed cannibalism on his body. And I'm sorry, like, it's very hard to read seriously, but I picture these scientists like, holy crap. Let's cut him up just to figure out what's going on. They're like, it's just seeds.
It's what he would have wanted. Let's plant him.
Oh, man. And it's so ridiculous. And you know it's not true, but you're just like, oh, this is amazing. This is the best thing I've ever read.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the interesting parts of that story is that the widow and the children are saved by their husband's pickled corpse turning into a profitable right. business. It makes them right. It makes them rich. So the seeds of their dried up dad turn them into rich farmers. It's like, it's crazy.
What was going through the widow's mind where it's just like, we should bury him. No, let's hang him up in the barn by his hair. Like, who does that?
Dearie me.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that is one of the weirdest stories in the book, I have to say. There are many of those, but that is in a class of its own, Adam.
It's so bizarre, too, that you think you would have heard about it before. But yes. Up until that point, I have never, ever heard the human cucumber story. And I went back to look through some of my stuff and, like, different collections that I know about. And not one has mentioned the human cucumber story. So it slipped under the radar real quick and got lost to time. And it's like being able to find that and like bring it back out.
Mm.
It's like that's like one of the big joys about doing these. It's like you're plucking them from obscurity and putting them back out to where they were meant to be so people can talk about them for years to come.
Yeah, I think... Adam, I would imagine that people have stumbled across that story before and gone, nah, I'm not bringing that out. People will think right. I'm crazy. But I congratulate you on releasing it into the world where it deserves to be.
The human cucumber is my gift to the world.
Yeah. I mean, there are some strange ones. Another one that's quite similar of weird growing things. Is one that made me chuckle when I saw it, because this is another it's just a bit odd. Grandma Fletcher, living on Weaver Street, Gainesville, Texas, is the possessor of a genuine freak of nature. Sometime during February, she purchased from a farmer a rustic table made of willow. It was neatly arranged and had been given two coats of varnish. She placed the table in her parlour, and there it has remained ever since. A few days ago, a roomer happened to notice the table and discovered twigs growing from each of the three legs. Some of the sprouts are now 8 inches long and no prospect of cessation of growth. Hundreds of Gainesville's best citizens have examined the freak and are all mystified.
Like that's something you would expect to see like in a traveling circus that comes to town. It's like for 5 cents, you could see the growing table. it's not hurting anyone. It's not like changing the game of, you know, the field. It's just a fun little story that just, it's like, here you go. This is something you can enjoy.
Oh, I do like the fact that this, well, it was a lovely table and it had two coats of varnish. With the greatest respect, we all know that a table's not going to start growing.
Right.
So it's, but it's the fact that everybody in Gainesville's been to see this freak. I think that's strong words for a table, to be honest. I've never heard of a table being called freaky before.
Yeah, it's like the term freak you're going to come across a lot in this book, primarily for the freaks of nature, quote unquote freaks of nature, also referred to as the Lusus Natura. I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly. I might not be. I apologize if I'm not. But which means freak of nature. And it's applied to, you know, a lot of the human-animal hybrids that they like to talk about in here, like half boy, half rooster, half alligator, half baby. You know, like pig born with elephant head, things like that. Which, you know, looking through it now, it's like, yeah, that's... Unfortunately, a lot of these could be chalked up to, you know, just a deformity at birth and trying to make a quick buck from the family and things like that, which is tragic. And like, don't get me wrong, I didn't put the stories in to laugh at some people's, you know, misfortune. But through the classic freak of nature aspect, you know, especially, you know, when you get the visualization of like the freak show, the banners outside where it's like literally a human body with a rooster head. That's what like these stories that they're using the term freak for are written as if it would be like a half animal, half alligator attached right at the middle. And, you know, to see that same term applied to a table is just like, okay, I guess. Sure. We're throwing the term around so willy-nilly, let's apply it to a table. Sure.
Freaky furniture, that's a whole new tenant of the Fortean phenomenon, Adam.
Yeah, someone should, like, you could, like, make that yours and be the first one in it.
Well, it certainly beats haunted furniture. I'll give it that much. At least this seems to be quite bound by nature. So it's, it's like, as you say, it's a very inoffensive yet peculiar story.
Right. And if you want to go the freak of nature, weird animal type of route, there's a story from 1868 on page 105 called A Monster of the Air.
Hmm.
And it's from the Wheeling Daily Intelligencer from West Virginia. And it took place in Chile on March 26. And they're talking about a group of workmen who were, you know, they're waiting for supper before going to work. And they saw flying through the air, which they first described as a gigantic bird. But looking at it as it passed over them, they noticed that it was very weirdly shaped and it had a strange body. They said that it had great wings, which were clothed with a brown plumage, but its head was in the shape similar to a grasshopper with giant eyes as bright as stars. And its body was also covered with like weird hair or bristles. It was as long as a serpent and it emitted metallic sounds. As it flew through the air, you know, it put everyone into just this sense of fear watching this thing. There were some people who said that it had like a horrible smell. Others said that it didn't. They just watched it, you know, fly through the air. And then eventually it was gone. Like it was just passing over. But it's this weird bird, grasshopper, dragon like creature they saw, just very fleeting. And that was it.
I think it's very interesting as well. I've noticed this in a few of these stories that clearly a lot of these journalists had read Arabian Nights, because there's a lot of mention of some of these stories. They're referring back to this classic collection of myth and legend that's been with us for centuries as well. And I found that a very interesting aspect, because I think in this particular story, they kind of try and tie it to the rock, which is obviously the giant bird from Arabian Nights and that kind of era of legend. And yet, when we hear the description, it's clearly not the Rock, because the Rock was often described as some kind of gigantic eagle that ate elephants. So this is a really weird description, though, because it's a grasshopper with wings. What, with hairy wings? What?
Yeah, and like a dragon, a body reminiscent of like a serpent, not necessarily like scales, but lengthwise, kind of like Falcor from Neverending Story. Like, that's what I kind of picture, where it's like hairy, you know, in that type of length. But the weird metallic sounds that it made, almost like it was, you know, a robot or some strange sort of ship. Definitely very odd.
Well, once again, I suppose, depending on your personal preference and slant, you could kind of pull that into the extraterrestrial UFO banner, I mm-hmm. suspect, Adam, because once again, it's one of those weird things, because obviously there are lots of stories from that era where people see flying serpents or dragons or giant birds. There aren't many where they describe some kind of weird grasshopper bird serpent sulfur emitting chimera.
Right. Yeah, it's definitely a very weird thing. It's just another one of those. Like, it's not hurting anyone. It's not causing any controversy. It's just a mark that down into the weird story and then move along.
Very true. And once again, it's one of those where it comes from Chile. So you're like, well, how's this story got out? It's one of those, like, as we were touching on the strange incident from Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
Often you would see in some of the earlier stories that they would basically a newspaper from Wisconsin or New York or Montana would basically tell people about something that happened in Mississippi or Florida, because it's 3,000 miles away and those people aren't going to know anything about it. And so towards the end of the 19th century, it's very interesting that a lot of these stories start happening abroad, which kind of says that people are getting a bit more upwardly mobile. And obviously you've got the trains being built across the US at that time. So I suppose, not that I suspect it, but maybe some of these newspaper editors were suspecting that people may jump on a train and go and investigate if there are dragons living in Alabama or wherever, Adam.
Right. Yeah. It's like, we need to make sure they stay here and they can't prove us wrong.
Yeah, it takes 3 weeks to get to Chile. They're not going to do that.
Right.
I think one of the other stories I absolutely loved, and because it's odd, it's strange, it's probably not true, and it's rather sweet, I think it's one of those stories in the book as well where the title tells us everything we need to know. And it's A Dog Playing Dominoes. And this is that a chap from London met a French man who was called Mr. Leonard, and he bred dogs for his own hobby. And this chap was invited to play a game of dominoes by Mr. Leonard, and was surprised to be joined by one of Mr. Leonard's dogs, who then proceeds to play him at dominoes. And the chap, quite in good fortune, said, oh, well, this is quite... He doesn't think anything... I mean, most people say, what the hell's going on here? How's this dog being able to play dominoes? But
right.
He plays along, and I find it very interesting that he decides to cheat and muck about, and the dog starts growling at him because he knows he's cheating.
Yeah, that's the fun part. It's like, oh, obviously this guy just trained this dog, you know, in a certain order to play dominoes, but it's like he tries to screw that up and the dog's like, no, like, I want to play this game. Like, this is for my enjoyment. It's like, oh, this might not be a trick.
Yeah, yeah. So he the dog basically nudges his bad domino out of the way, replaces it, and proceeds to beat him at dominoes, which is even more remarkable. So he's a man who's not ashamed to admit that he's been beaten at dominoes by a Spanish dog.
I wouldn't tell anyone that. Like, that's something I'd keep to myself.
But that's one of the stories you think, what on earth is going on here? Because that's
right.
There are some wonderful stories just like this one. There's another one about a story in Canada where a man's killed by a mouse that accidentally runs into his open mouth while he's laughing and kills him. And you're just like, what?
Right. Like, there's those stories that are so, they're just like very brief. And all of a sudden it's like a twist at the end where it's just like, I did not see that coming. Like, there's one that comes to mind. I don't know the name offhand, but it just, the mouse one reminded me of it, just of that you don't expect it. There's this story about this man who's looking for the Philosopher's Stone. And for those who aren't aware, you know, the Philosopher's Stone was believed to be discovered by Nicholas Flamel, and it could transmutate base metals into gold and silver, depending on which one you found. Some people believe that, you know, it was a combination of different things, and other people believe that it was an actual stone. And in this story, this man claims he knows where the Philosopher's Stone is. He says it's like at a river or something like that. So he's going through and he's picking up these stones, and every stone he picks up, he holds to a piece of base metal. It doesn't change. He throws the stone. Eventually, he picks up this actual stone, but he's in such a rhythm where as soon as the base metal changes, he throws the stone out into the river, and then he realizes what he did, and then it's like gone forever again. Like, it's just that moment of, it was right there, and you, like, the whole story just changed and just ends, and you're just like, now he's like shit out of luck. Like, he just screwed up. The same thing with the dog playing dominoes. Just like, he tried to cheat, the dog beat you, now it's done. Or you laughed and a mouse ran down your throat and now you're dead. it's that type of thing where it's just like, yeah, this feels like, this story feels a column. Let's put it out there. People will enjoy it. There's a whole bunch of like those throughout here. Just those little fun stories that you come across and you're like, man, that'd be wild if that was true.
Yeah.
And then you turn the page and you go to another one that's just like it.
Yeah. And they're always filled with these sort of facts that aren't true, like the mouse one. It says it's well known that mice can survive without air. Is it?
It's like, maybe that might be true in certain like really controlled conditions, but I highly doubt a mouse is also going to be able to survive inside the human body.
Oh, I think one of the great titles that you mentioned, another story that you wanted to talk about, has a fabulous title, which is A Queer Old Bugaboo.
Yes. It's one of those stories that it's, so you read it, it's got the creepy factor to it, but it's also got those hints that we kind of touched on earlier, where like, they're still being reported today, but in a different sense. So, this story is called A Queer Old Bugaboo, and it was written October 9th, 1883 in the Daily Gazette from Delaware. The secondary headline is, What a Little Miss Saw as She Skipped Along the Spring. And they're talking about this daughter of Captain William L. Pratt of King George County. She was on her way down to the spring to get water, and she's past this tree, what is described as an indescribable sensation came over her. Her hair felt as though it was standing on end, and there was a heavy pressure on her shoulders, which almost made her fall to the ground. From behind that same tree crossed the path in front of her and disappeared. It was described as a weird humanoid that was floating above the ground. It was covered with something like an old coat with the sleeves hanging down. Its head was covered with short, kinky hair, but it possessed no face, eyes, or feet. It disappeared in an open space. And then when it was gone, like that sensation that came over that girl completely vanished. And she ran back to her family to describe what had happened. At the end of the story, it says the girl was 11 years old. Now, it's crazy to read because it's got that creep factor, but that sensation of extreme pressure and like kind of falling to the ground and, you know, just feeling odd at a moment's notice, people still report having that, you know, if they go into certain like haunted locations, or if you subscribe to the quote unquote paranormal Bigfoot theory, that, you know, people encounter those same sensations when like a Bigfoot is in the area or things like that. So, you know, being able to link something from 1883 again to modern times, which people are still describing in certain situations, is really interesting. The, the character and focus might be different, but the phenomenon is the same.
It is strange because obviously in this report, the girl claims that she's frozen to the spot. She can't move, she can't talk, and she's overcome with this. And I know one of the best examples of this is in Keel's The Mothman Prophecies, where he finds these pockets of fear, Adam, where you can basically walk through them and you feel like, oh, you're absolutely terrified, you're scared out of your wits, and then you can step out of it. And it's very interesting to see that we've got these kind of aspects to some of these stories that have become quite out there these days in regards to more sort of Fortean thinking when it comes to strange window areas and pockets of the Americas where these areas are. And yet this is a really old story where we've got this strange description and this emotional response to seeing it.
Right. And it almost takes on like a description of, like, you know, the classic banshee, like no face, no legs, nothing like that. Or, you know, any sort of strange ghost in the terms of, you know, classic hauntings, you know, they would often, you know, every once in a while you get the one that was described as the same way. And, you know, I highly doubt the person who wrote this, the reporter for the Daily Gazette back in 1883, was some, like, you know, early pioneer of Fortean themes and writing. They just wrote down what they heard, but they had no idea that, you know, years later, this would be a drop in a bucket of other things that have been described exactly the same way. And it's so crazy to think that, like, all of this is connected in a way, if you're willing to, like, figure out how it's connected. It's fascinating and cool, and also a little disturbing.
Yes.
At the same time, where it's like that, it's like, man, what don't we know? But, you know, is all the exact same? It like takes you down those rabbit holes that if you're willing to go down, it's like, you might figure something out, you might not figure anything out, but you're going to learn a lot along the way.
I'm very interested as well in this report that the girl takes this experience as a portent of doom because her father's not at home, and she believes that this symbolizes that something bad's happened to her father. Thankfully, nothing had. He returns home and she's delighted to see him. I think that's a very interesting cultural aspect of the story because it kind of leans into a kind of premonition of seeing a ghost and that giving it meaning. It's the bearer of bad news, Adam.
Yeah, that harbinger of doom or bad omen way of thinking that a lot of people, you know, will apply to situations like this.
Yeah, it's a very creepy tale because it's a very strange sounding creature, as you say, just sort of floating around, and who knows what it could mean. And it's, like I say, I found the last couple of paragraphs where they're talking about it being a portent a very interesting aspect of that, because I didn't expect the story to end in the way it did.
Yeah, and they always make sure to point out that, like, you know, the prominent people in the story, whether it's, you know, like a public official or this, in this situation, they're the important person is the father. But they always make sure to point out that they're not a believer in supernatural things or stuff like that. So it's like, listen, they're not making this up because they don't believe it. So it's like, okay, I don't believe in a lot of things, but it's like, I'm not going to say I wouldn't make it up just because I was bored or something like that. And I'm not saying that the people made this up, but it's like, that was their go-to, like, you can trust us. This person doesn't believe in ghosts.
Well, strangely enough, talking of not making things up, Adam, that kind of leads into one of the wonderful stories in this book that I would be disappointed if I didn't mention, which is on page 571. And this is just, as we talked about the dog that can play dominoes, Adam, I have a feeling that this story isn't true. But this story is called...
Are you willing to bet on that it isn't true?
After reading this book, I'm not sure what's real anymore, Adam. I'll tell you that. and it's called Hen with Gopher Face. And this tells us of a very interesting farmer called Wilhelm Peterson, who claims that he had a hen, but it had the head of a gopher. And it was It came out of a normal batch of eggs. It hatched. And unlike the rest of the hens that were living with it, this hen somehow had got a gopher's head. And he tells us that instead of picking her feet off the ground as the chicken does, it takes the kernels of grain and nibbles them as a gopher does, then drinks water like a cat, lapping it up with his tongue. Now, this chap's very proud of this, and he's offering people to come and see it for 5 cents. You can come and see the chicken with a gopher head. Whether this chicken actually moves or not, Adam, I'm not sure, because it doesn't seem to tell us.
Right.
Only Mr. Peterson claims to have seen it do anything, like move or eat or drink. And it says that he was offered $25 for this strange creature by a gentleman called Ed Drinkwater. But he says, I think it's worth more than $1,000 if it was worth a cent. And if he can't get the price in this country, he may conclude to take it to Denmark this fall, where people know how to value such a freak and are ever willing to pay the price. Now, I wasn't aware that there was a big market in Denmark for freaks. So this was all news to me. I'm not sure. But that's one of those wonderful parts of these stories, that there are these really odd twists at the end.
Right.
Why Denmark?
Two things about this story. One, Wilhelm Peterson comes across as that kid who, if you're not playing the game he wants to play, he's like, well, I'm grabbing my football and I'm going home.
Yes.
Then none of you can play. And two, I would totally pay 5 cents
to see
this. Like, I am that sucker that, you know, that quote attributes to is born every minute. Because if you tell me that you have a chicken with a gopher head, or you have a cat with an elephant head, I will give you whatever you want so I can see that. Just to say I saw it. Like, I am the demographic for these quote-unquote freaks of nature.
I suspect that Mr. Peterson may have unfortunately taken some kind of influence from the works of Mary Shelley with this chicken with a gopher head. I'm not really sure that these two creatures are the same thing.
It's just so weird how confident he is, where it's just like, you know who would appreciate this? The people of Denmark. Like, they didn't even have a say in it. Like, he's just throwing them out there like they love their freaks.
Yeah, yeah. Gopher-headed chickens are massive in Copenhagen.
It's like, okay. Then go. I got one last one that I really enjoy. Because it's got that creep factor to it. And it's also got a theme that we have seen recently in modern horror movies.
Yes.
Like, this is something that it's everyone who is a fan of the horror genre, or like the ghost story genre, anything like that, has seen this particular scene appear. Only this one happened October 28th, 1875. It's called Mysterious Footprints. It was in the West Jersey Pioneer from New Jersey. And it's talking about, it says, a few days ago, a phenomenon of a very singular nature occurred at the residence of a Mr. Veter at number 37 Albany Street, which, just a little segue, I love so much that back in the day, if you experienced something weird, they were putting your full name and address in the paper. Like, you had no privacy at all. So at this dude's house, his wife was, you know, going about the daily household duties, when all of a sudden, according to her statement, a flash of light filled the room. She was so overcome by the strange occurrence that she screamed, but the light then disappeared. And after the light was gone, she kind of looked up to the ceiling, and she saw little child footprints on the ceiling. She kind of stood there watching, like looking at the ceiling, and then all of a sudden she saw another footprint appear on the ceiling, which then appeared like in step, as if something was walking. She freaked out. She ran from the room. She ran to her neighbor's house. She called her neighbor over there because, of course, when you're terrified, you want someone else to be terrified with you. So it's like, come back over here and see what I'm seeing in my house.
See how scared it makes you feel.
Right. It's also that moment to verify that's like, I am not crazy. I need someone else to see this type of thing. So the other woman arrived at the house and they watched, and all these footprints started appearing all over the ceiling. Eventually, the whole ceiling was almost covered. It was crossing the walls and everything. And then eventually, it also started to walk and leave footprints on the ceiling of different rooms. They were all of a child's foot, and they were all of the same size. It says the ceiling, like all others at this time of the year, is more or less colored, painted. But the marks on the wall look like white spots of the foot of a footprint. Some were able to be rubbed off, and some of them remained there. So whatever this thing was in this flash of light was walking on the ceiling. And it brings to mind, like I said, those horror movies where like handprints will just start appearing all over the place, whether it's on a wall or like on the main character or something. Those disembodied prints will just suddenly appear and freak everyone out. But this woman, you know, experienced it back in the 1800s. And it kind of makes me think, was this a common occurrence for it to become a theme later on in life? Did someone hear about this from like a relative that got passed down from generation to generation? Or was this someone just they thought they made this up, not knowing that this is something that was reported on before? Just one of those instances where it's like really interesting to see that it's still like something we recognize today. And it just kind of like stuck out as a memorable story.
I think the odd aspect of this is that these footprints are on the ceiling, not the floor, which makes you think, well, why is whatever this is walking upside down? Why is it on the ceiling? How is it able to go through into another bedroom and carry on doing the same? Whereas, as you say there, these days, the cliche ones are handprints on windows, or they appear in bathroom mirrors or things like that. Or you'll see wet footprints appearing on the floor or something like that. It's very odd, and I'm not aware of anything similar that predates it in the paranormal sense. Certainly not a very well-known story, Adam, that you could think, well, maybe they've just copied it out. I think what makes this story interesting is that it seems to be unusually unique.
Yeah, there's something about it. It's like it's almost like it activates that lizard brain part where it's like, you know, something is wrong in a room, and then all of a sudden that something like shows itself, but you still can't figure out what it is. So it's like it piques that like terrifying response, like, okay, I understand something weird is happening here, and these footprints are appearing, but what is leaving the footprints? What does it look like? Why is it doing this? So it's tapping into those different layers of fear. And then, of course, it just ends. It's like, haha, it's done. Maybe this could happen to you. Or it's like, I don't want to read anymore.
The dangers of housework, Adam.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it was. Someone's just like, they didn't want to do their chores anymore. And they're just like, well, this is why I don't, because my house is possessed by the devil.
Yeah, I polished wrong. And look what's happened.
Yeah. No, but there's tons of stories like that. And I tried to keep them, you know, not overload on one specific type. So it jumps around a lot. You got, you know, ghost stories, monster stories, of course, you know, from the previous two volumes. It's just like, well, I can't not go back to those because they're so enjoyable. But you also got, you know, spontaneous combustion, early UFO accounts, the freaks of nature, just the absolutely bizarre, like the unprepared for discovery of like a random human head. It's like, oh, that's a weird story. Let's put that in the morning paper. It's just, it's so expansive that if you can't find a story you don't like in here, then maybe this just isn't the particular field for you to be in, because there's so much that I came across and it was so fun to share.
Absolutely. I think the first, like I said earlier on, the first two decades just have such a rich choice of phenomena and incident and articles that just cover anything. And I think if you don't find anything that you enjoy in the first two decades of this book, this isn't the book for you, and this isn't the field for you. Because if you don't enjoy a story about a bear getting a lift or spontaneous human combustion, then I don't know what to say to you, Adam, to be fair. It's a marvellous collection, as you say. There are some wonderfully weird stories. Another one that we've not had a chance to touch on is the guys that claim a UFO dropped a letter off and that they needed to post for them.
There's what is supposed would be considered like a Bigfoot scene in Chicago.
Yes.
On the frozen Chicago River.
Yeah.
There is, of course, classic accounts of raining snakes and raining frogs and fish and blood. And there's one where like a man shoots a gun up at a cloud and the bullet gets stuck in the cloud and turns into ice and then falls back down. Like just weird stuff. It's like that wouldn't happen, but I guess it did. Okay.
Yeah. And let's not forget the lightning that only kills black sheep.
Yeah, that was I read that one a few times. Like, am I missing something at this? Like, it's literally choosing the sheep that it's killing.
I mean, that is a strange thing because that is a weird natural phenomenon that does occur, because there was a very famous case a few years ago where a herd of reindeer were all killed by a lightning strike because they were all stood in a certain way. And I know it's happened with herds of cows as well, Adam, where they've all been closely spaced and obviously the lightning's just jumped between them and sadly killed them all. So that's not an unusual phenomenon. The fact that it's killing black sheep out of a mixed flock of black and white sheep is a very peculiar incident. And yet when they're reporting what's happened to them, it clearly sounds like they've been struck by lightning.
Yeah, it's definitely a weird one. And it's, like you said, it's not out of the realm of possibility to happen, but how it happened is what makes it strange.
Clearly, black fleece is more conductive. That's all I can. All I've learned from that. Well, Adam, I congratulate you on a wonderful, weighty collection of fabulous historical accounts. Where can everybody keep up to date with you and your marvelous work with the Pine Barrens Institute and get a copy of this fantastic book?
Everything can be found at pinebarrensinstitute.com. You got links to the books, you got links to Instagram, Twitter, all that, all the original articles that, you know, I'm now getting back into posting because the book is done, so I can get back into those focal pieces. Everything can be found there, and then, you know, active across Twitter and Instagram and stuff like that. So if you like weird stuff, you know, it's all at one convenient location.
Fabulous. Well, as always, Adam, I heartily recommend your website and your latest release, and I will wish
Thank you.
A great thanks for speaking with me, as always. It's been too long. It's always a pleasure. I'm always delighted to see your latest releases. And this is a wonderful book. I congratulate you heartily on it. And I wish you the very best of luck. And hopefully we will speak soon.
Thank you. And yeah, we definitely have to make it more than a once a year thing.
No problems. Take care, Adam.
You as well.